I drove up to Cedarhurst and picked up my bride. Arlene's family waved goodbye, and off we went. We crossed Queens and Brooklyn, then went to Staten Island on the ferry. That was our romantic boat ride, and drove to the City Hall for the borough of Richmond to get married. We went up the stairs slowly into the office. The guy there was very nice. He did everything right away. He said, "You don't have any witnesses." So we called the bookkeeper and an accountant from another room, and we were married according to the laws of the state of New York. Then we were very happy, and we smiled at each other, holding hands. The bookkeeper says to me, "You're married now. You should kiss the bride." So the bashful character kissed his bride lightly on the cheek. I gave everyone a tip, and we thanked them very much. We got back in the car and drove to Deborah Hospital. Every weekend, I'd go down from Princeton to visit Arlene. One time, the bus was late, and I couldn't get into the hospital. There weren't any hotels nearby, but I had my old sheepskin coat on, so I was warm enough, and I looked for an empty lot to sleep in. I was a little worried what it might look like in the morning when people looked out of their windows, so I found a place that was far enough away from houses. The next morning I woke up and discovered I'd been sleeping in a garbage dump, a landfill. I felt foolish and laughed. Arlene's doctor was very nice, but he would get upset when I brought in a war bond for $18 every month. He could see we didn't have much money, and kept insisting we shouldn't contribute to the hospital, but I did it anyway. One time at Princeton, I received a box of pencils in the mail. They were dark green, and in gold letters were the words, "Richard, darling, I love you. Putsy." It was Arlene. I called her Putsy. Well, that was nice, and I love her too. But you know how you absent-mindedly drop pencils around. You're showing Professor Wigner a formula or something, and leave the pencil on his desk. In those days, we didn't have extra stuff, so I didn't want to waste the pencils. I got a razor blade from the bathroom and cut off the writing on one of them to see if I could use them. The next morning, I get a letter in the mail. It starts out, "What's the idea of trying to cut the name off the pencils?" It continues, "Aren't you proud of the fact that I love you?" Then, "What do you care what other people think?" Then came poetry. "If you're ashamed of me, da, da, then pecans to you, pecans to you." The next verse was the same kind of stuff, with the last line, "Almonds to you, almonds to you." Each one was nuts to you in a different form. So I had to use the pencils with the names on them. What else could I do? It wasn't long before I had to go to Los Alamos. Robert Oppenheimer, who was in charge of the project, arranged for Arlene to stay in the nearest hospital in Albuquerque, about 100 miles away. I had time off every weekend to see her. So I would hitchhike down on a Saturday, see Arlene in the afternoon, and stay overnight in a hotel there in Albuquerque. Then, on Sunday morning, I would see Arlene again and hitchhike back to Los Alamos in the afternoon. During the week, I would often get letters from her. Some of them, like the one written on a jigsaw puzzle blank, and then taken apart and sent in a sack, resulted in little notes from the Army censor, such as, "Please tell your wife we don't have time to play games around here." I didn't tell her anything. I liked her to play games, even though she often put me in various uncomfortable but amusing conditions from which I could not escape. One time, near the beginning of May, newspapers mysteriously appeared in almost everybody's mailbox at Los Alamos. The whole damn place was full of them, hundreds of newspapers. You know the kind. You open it up, and there's this headline screaming in thick letters across the front page. "Entire Nation Celebrates Birthday of R.P. Feynman." Arlene was playing her game with the world. She had a lot of time to think. She would read magazines and send away for this and that. She was always cooking up something. She must have got help with the names from Nick Metropolis or one of the other guys at Los Alamos who would often visit her. Arlene was in her room, but she was in the world, writing me crazy letters and sending away for all kinds of stuff. One time she sent me a big catalog of kitchen equipment, the kind you need for enormous institutions like prisons, which have a lot of people in them. It showed everything from blowers and hoods for stoves to huge pots and pans. So I'm thinking, what the hell is this? It reminded me of the time I was up at MIT, and Arlene sent me a catalog describing huge boats from warships to ocean liners, great big boats. I wrote to her, "What's the idea?" She writes back, "I just thought that maybe, when we get married, we could buy a boat." I write, "Are you crazy? It's all out of proportion." Then another catalog comes. It's for big yachts, 40-foot schooners and stuff like that, for very rich people. She writes, "Since you said no to the other boats, maybe we could get one of these." I write, "Look, you're way out of scale." Soon another catalog comes. It's for various kinds of motorboats, Christcraft this and that. I write, "Too expensive." Finally, I get a note. "This is your last chance, Richard. You're always saying no." It turns out a friend of hers has a rowboat she wants to sell for $15, a used rowboat, and maybe we could buy it so we could row around in the water next summer. So yes, I mean, how can you say no after all that? Well, I'm still trying to figure out what this big catalog for institutional kitchen equipment is leading to, when another catalog comes. It's for hotels and restaurants, supplies for small and medium-sized hotels and restaurants. Then a few days later, a catalog for the kitchen in your new home comes. When I go down to Albuquerque the next Saturday, I find out what it's all about. There's a little charcoal broiler in her room. She's bought it through the mail from Sears. It's about 18 inches across with little legs. "I thought we could have steaks," Arlene says. "How the hell can we use it in the room here with all the smoke and everything?" "Oh, no," she says. "All you have to do is take it out on the lawn. Then you can cook us steaks every Sunday." The hospital was right on Route 66, the main road across the United States. "I can't do that," I said. "I mean, with all the cars and trucks going by, all the people on the sidewalk walking back and forth, I can't just go out there and start cooking steaks on the lawn." "What do you care what other people think?" Arlene tortured me with that. "Okay," she says, opening a drawer, "we'll compromise. You don't have to wear the chef's hat and the gloves." She holds up a hat. It's a real chef's hat and gloves. Then she says, "Try on the apron," as she unfolds it. It has something silly written across it, like Barbecue King or something. "Okay, okay," I say, horrified. "I'll cook the steaks on the lawn." So every Saturday or Sunday, I go out there on Route 66 and cook steaks. Then there were the Christmas cards. One day, only a few weeks after I had arrived at Los Alamos, Arlene says, "I thought it would be nice to send Christmas cards to everybody. Would you like to see the ones I picked out?" They were nice cards, all right, but inside they said Merry Christmas from Rich and Putsy. "I can't send these to Fermi and Beta," I protested. "I hardly even know them." "What do you care what other people think?" Naturally. So we sent them. Next year comes around, and by this time I know Fermi. I know Beta. I've been over at their houses. I've taken care of their kids. We're all very friendly. Somewhere along the line, Arlene says to me in a very formal tone, "You haven't asked me about our Christmas cards this year, Richard." Fear goes through me. Well, let's see the cards. The cards say Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year from Richard and Arlene Feynman. "Well, that's fine," I say. "They're very nice. They'll go fine for everybody." "Oh, no," she says. "They won't do for Fermi and Beta and all those other famous people." Sure enough, she's got another box of cards. She pulls one out. It says the usual stuff, and then, "From Dr. and Mrs. R. P. Feynman." So I had to send them those. "What's this formal stuff, Dick?" they laughed. They were happy that she was having such a good time out of it, and that I had no control over it. Arlene didn't spend all of her time inventing games. She had sent away for a book called Sound and Symbol in Chinese. It was a lovely book. I still have it, with about 50 symbols done in beautiful calligraphy, with explanations like, "Trouble, three women in a house." She had the right paper, brushes, and ink, and was practicing calligraphy. She had also bought a Chinese dictionary to get a lot of other symbols. One time, when I came to visit her, Arlene was practicing these things. She says to herself, "No, that one's wrong." So I, the great scientist, say, "What do you mean, wrong? It's only a human convention. There is no law of nature which says how they're supposed to look. You can draw them any way you want." "I mean, artistically, it's wrong. It's a question of balance, of how it feels." "But one way is just as good as another," I protest. "Here," she says, and she hands me the brush. "Make one yourself." So I made one, and I said, "Wait a minute. Let me make another one. It's too blobby." I couldn't say it was wrong, after all. How do you know how blobby it's supposed to be? She says. I learned what she meant. There's a particular way you have to make the stroke for it to look good. An aesthetic thing has a certain set, a certain character, which I can't define. Because it couldn't be defined made me think there was nothing to it. But I learned from that experience that there is something to it. And it's a fascination I've had for art ever since. Just at this moment, my sister sends me a postcard from Oberlin, where she's going to college. It's written in pencil with small symbols. It's in Chinese. Joan is 9 years younger than I am, and studied physics, too. Having me as her older brother was tough on her. She was always looking for something I couldn't do, and was secretly taking Chinese. Well, I didn't know any Chinese, but one thing I'm good at is spending an infinite amount of time solving a puzzle. The next weekend, I took the card with me to Albuquerque. Arlene showed me how to look up the symbols. You have to start in the back of the dictionary with the right category and count the number of strokes. Then you go into the main part of the dictionary. It turns out each symbol has several possible meanings, and you have to put several symbols together before you can understand it. With great patience, I worked everything out. Joan was saying things like, I had a good time today. There was only one sentence I couldn't figure out. It said, Yesterday we celebrated Mountain Forming Day. Obviously an error. It turned out they did have some crazy thing called Mountain Forming Day at Oberlin, and I had translated it right. So it was trivial things like you'd expect to have on a postcard, but I knew from the situation that Joan was trying to floor me by sending me Chinese. I looked back and forth through the art book and picked out four symbols which would go well together. Then I practiced each one over and over. I had a big pad of paper, and I would make 50 of each one until I got it just right. When I had accidentally made one good example of each symbol, I saved them. Arlene approved, and we glued the four of them end to end, one on top of the other. Then we put a little piece of wood on each end, so you could hang it up on the wall. I took a picture of my masterpiece with Nick Metropolis's camera, rolled up the scroll, put it in a tube, and sent it to Joan. So she gets it. She unrolls it, and she can't read it. It looks to her as if I simply made four characters, one right after the other on the scroll. She takes it to her teacher. The first thing he says is, This is written rather well. Did you do this? No. What does it say? Elder brother also speaks. I'm a real bastard. I would never let my little sister score one on me. When Arlene's condition became much weaker, her father came out from New York to visit her. It was difficult and expensive to travel that far during the war, but he knew the end was near. One day he telephoned me at Los Alamos. You'd better come down here right away, he said.
I had arranged ahead of time with a friend of mine at Los Alamos, Klaus Fuchs, to borrow his car in case of an emergency, so I could get to Albuquerque quickly. I picked up a couple of hitchhikers to help me in case something happened on the way.
Sure enough, as we were driving into Santa Fe, we got a flat tire. The hitchhikers helped me change the tire. Then, on the other side of Santa Fe, the spare tire went flat, but there was a gas station nearby. I remember waiting patiently for the gas station man to take care of some other car, when the two hitchhikers, knowing the situation, went over and explained to the man what it was. He fixed the flat right away. We decided not to get the spare tire fixed because repairing it would have taken even more time. We started out again towards Albuquerque, and I felt foolish that I hadn't thought to say anything to the gas station man when time was so precious. About 30 miles from Albuquerque, we got another flat. We had to abandon the car, and we hitchhiked the rest of the way. I called up a towing company and told them the situation. I met Arlene's father at the hospital. He had been there for a few days. I can't take it anymore, he said. I have to go home. He was so unhappy, he just left. When I finally saw Arlene, she was very weak and a bit fogged out. She didn't seem to know what was happening. She stared straight ahead most of the time, looking around a little bit from time to time, and was trying to breathe. Every once in a while, her breathing would stop, and she would sort of swallow, and then it would start again. It kept going like this for a few hours. I took a little walk outside for a while.
I was surprised that I wasn't feeling what I thought people were supposed to feel under the circumstances. Maybe I was fooling myself. I wasn't delighted, but I didn't feel terribly upset, perhaps because we had known for a long time that it was going to happen.
It's hard to explain. If a Martian, who we'll imagine never dies except by accident, came to Earth and saw this peculiar race of creatures, these humans who live about 70 or 80 years, knowing that death is going to come, it would look to him like a terrible problem of psychology to live under those circumstances, knowing that life is only temporary. Well, we humans somehow figure out how to live despite this problem. We laugh, we joke, we live. The only difference for me and Arlene was, instead of 50 years, it was 5 years. It was only a quantitative difference. The psychological problem was just the same. The only way it would have become any different is if we had said to ourselves, "But those other people have it better, because they might live 50 years. But that's crazy. Why make yourself miserable saying things like, "Why do we have such bad luck? What has God done to us? What have we done to deserve this?" All of which, if you understand reality and take it completely into your heart, are irrelevant and unsolvable. They are just things that nobody can know. Your situation is just an accident of life. We had a hell of a good time together. I came back into her room. I kept imagining all the things that were going on physiologically. The lungs aren't getting enough air into the blood, which makes the brain fogged out and the heart weaker, which makes the breathing even more difficult. I kept expecting some sort of avalanching effect, with everything caving in together in a dramatic collapse. But it didn't appear that way at all. She just slowly got more foggy, and her breathing gradually became less and less, until there was no more breath. But just before that, there was a very small one.
The nurse on her rounds came in and confirmed that Arlene was dead and went out. I wanted to be alone for a moment. I sat there for a while, and then went over to kiss her one last time. I was very surprised to discover that her hair smelled exactly the same. Of course, after I stopped and thought about it, there was no reason why hair should smell different in such a short time. But to me it was a kind of a shock, because in my mind something enormous had just happened, and yet nothing had happened. The next day I went to the mortuary. The guy hands me some rings he'd taken from her body. "Would you like to see your wife one last time?" he asks. What kind of a "no"? "I don't want to see her, no," I said. "I just saw her." "Yes, but she's been all fixed up," he says. This mortuary stuff was completely foreign to me. Fixing up a body when there's nothing there? I didn't want to look at Arlene again. That would have made me more upset. I called the towing company and got the car and packed Arlene's stuff in the back. I picked up a hitchhiker and started out of Albuquerque. It wasn't more than 5 miles before, bang, another flat tire. I started to curse. The hitchhiker looked at me like I was mentally unbalanced. "It's just a tire, isn't it?" he says. "Yeah, it's just a tire. And another tire. And again another tire. And another tire." We put the spare tire on and went very slowly all the way back to Los Alamos, without getting the other tire repaired. I didn't know how I was going to face all my friends at Los Alamos. I didn't want people with long faces talking to me about the death of Arlene. Somebody asked me what happened. "She's dead. And how's the program going?" I said. They caught on right away that I didn't want to moon over it. Only one guy expressed his sympathy, and it turned out he had been out of town when I came back to Los Alamos. One night I had a dream, and Arlene came into it. Right away I said to her, "No, no, you can't be in this dream. You're not alive." Then later, I had another dream with Arlene in it. I started in again, saying, "You can't be in this dream." "No, no," she says. "I fooled you. I was tired of you. So I cooked up this ruse so I could go my own way. But now I like you again, so I've come back." My mind was really working against itself. It had to be explained, even in a goddamn dream, why it was possible that she was still there. I must have done something to myself psychologically. I didn't cry until about a month later, when I was walking past a department store in Oak Ridge, and noticed a pretty dress in the window. I thought, "Arlene would like that." And then it hit me. It's as simple as 1, 2, 3. When I was a kid growing up in Far Rockaway, I had a friend named Bernie Walker. we both had labs at home, and we would do various experiments. One time we were discussing something. We must have been 11 or 12 at the time, and I said, "But thinking is nothing but talking to yourself inside." "Oh, yeah," Bernie said. "Do you know the crazy shape of the crankshaft in a car?" "Yeah. What of it?" "Good. Now tell me, how did you describe it when you were talking to yourself?"
So I learned from Bernie that thoughts can be visual as well as verbal. Later on in college, I became interested in dreams. I wondered how things could look so real, just as if light were hitting the retina of the eye, while the eyes are closed. Are the nerve cells on the retina actually being stimulated in some other way? By the brain itself, perhaps? Or does the brain have a judgment department that gets slopped up during dreaming? I never got satisfactory answers to such questions from psychology, even though I became very interested in how the brain works. Instead, there was all this business about interpreting dreams and so on. When I was in graduate school at Princeton, a kind of dumb psychology paper came out that stirred up a lot of discussion. The author had decided that the thing controlling the time sense in the brain is a chemical reaction involving iron. I thought to myself, now how the hell could he figure that? Well, the way he did it was his wife had a chronic fever which went up and down a lot. Somehow he got the idea to test her sense of time. He had her count seconds to herself without looking at a clock, and checked how long it took her to count up to 60. He had her counting, the poor woman, all during the day. When her fever went up, he found she counted quicker. When her fever went down, she counted slower. Therefore, he thought, the thing that governed the time sense in the brain must be running faster when she's got fever than when she hasn't got fever. Being a very scientific guy, the psychologist knew that the rate of a chemical reaction varies with the surrounding temperature by a certain formula that depends on the energy of the reaction. He measured the differences in speed of his wife's counting and determined how much the temperature changed the speed. Then he tried to find a chemical reaction whose rates varied with temperature in the same amounts as his wife's counting did. He found that iron reactions fit the pattern best. So he deduced that his wife's sense of time was governed by a chemical reaction in her body involving iron. Well, it all seemed like a lot of baloney to me. There were so many things that could go wrong in his long chain of reasoning. But it was an interesting question. What does determine the time sense? When you're trying to count at an even rate, what does that rate depend on? And what could you do to yourself to change it? I decided to investigate. I started by counting seconds, without looking at a clock, of course, up to 60 in a slow, steady rhythm. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. When I got to 60, only 48 seconds had gone by. But that didn't bother me. The problem was not to count for exactly 1 minute, but to count at a standard rate. The next time I counted to 60, 49 seconds had passed. The next time, 48. Then 47. 48, 49, 48, 48. So I found I could count at a pretty standard rate. Now, if I just sat there without counting and waited until I thought a minute had gone by, it was very irregular, complete variations. So I found it's very poor to estimate a minute by sheer guessing. But by counting, I could get very accurate. Now that I knew I could count at a standard rate, the next question was, what affects the rate? Maybe it has something to do with the heart rate. So I began to run up and down the stairs, up and down, to get my heart beating fast. Then I'd run into my room, throw myself down on the bed, and count up to 60. I also tried running up and down the stairs and counting to myself while I was running up and down. The other guys saw me running up and down the stairs and laughed. "What are you doing?" I couldn't answer them, which made me realize I couldn't talk while I was counting to myself, and kept right on running up and down the stairs, looking like an idiot. The guys at the graduate college were used to me looking like an idiot. On another occasion, for example, a guy came into my room. I had forgotten to lock the door during the experiment, and found me in a chair wearing my heavy sheepskin coat, leaning out of the wide-open window in the dead of winter, holding a pot in one hand and stirring with the other. "Don't bother me, don't bother me," I said. I was stirring Jell-O and watching it closely. I had gotten curious as to whether Jell-O would coagulate in the cold if he kept it moving all the time. Anyway, after trying every combination of running up and down the stairs and lying on the bed, surprise,
the heart rate had no effect. And since I got very hot running up and down the stairs, I figured temperature had nothing to do with it either. Although I must have known that your temperature doesn't really go up when you exercise. In fact, I couldn't find anything that affected my rate of counting. Running up and down stairs got pretty boring, so I started counting while I did things I had to do anyway. For instance, when I put out the laundry, I had to fill out a form saying how many shirts I had, how many pants, and so on. I found I could write down 3 in front of pants or 4 in front of shirts, but I couldn't count my socks. There were too many of them. I'm already using my counting machine. 36, 37, 38, and here are all these socks in front of me. 39, 40, 41. How do I count the socks? I found I could arrange them in geometrical patterns, like a square, for example. A pair of socks in this corner, a pair in that corner, a pair over here, and a pair over there. 8 socks. I continued this game of counting by patterns and found I could count the lines in a newspaper article by grouping the lines into patterns of 3, 3, 3, and 1 to get 10. Then 3 of those patterns, 3 of those patterns, 3 of those patterns, and 1 of those patterns made 100. I went right down the newspaper like that. After I had finished counting up to 60, I knew where I was in the patterns and could say, "I'm up to 60, and there are 113 lines." I found that I could even read the articles while I counted to 60, and it didn't affect the rate. In fact, I could do anything while counting to myself, except talk out loud, of course. What about typing, copying words out of a book? I found that I could do that, too, but here my time was affected. I was excited. Finally, I found something that appears to affect my counting rate. I investigated it more. I would go along typing the simple words rather fast, counting to myself, 19, 20, 21, typing along, counting 27, 28, 29, typing along until, what the hell is that word? Oh, yeah, and then continue counting, 30, 31, 32, and so on. When I'd get to 60, I'd be late. After some introspection and further observation, I realized what must have happened. I would interrupt my counting when I got to a difficult word that needed more brains, so to speak. My counting rate wasn't slowing down. Rather, the counting itself was being held up temporarily from time to time. Counting to 60 had become so automatic that I didn't even notice the interruptions at first. The next morning, over breakfast, I reported the results of all these experiments to the other guys at the table. I told them all the things I could do while counting to myself, and said the only thing I absolutely could not do while counting to myself was talk. One of the guys, a fellow named John Tukey, said, "I don't believe you can read, and I don't see why you can't talk. I'll bet you I can talk while counting to myself, and I'll bet you you can't read." So I gave a demonstration. They gave me a book, and I read it for a while, counting to myself. When I reached 60, I said, "Now." 48 seconds, my regular time. Then I told them what I had read. Tukey was amazed. After we checked him a few times to see what his regular time was, he started talking. "Mary had a little lamb. I can say anything I want to. It doesn't make any difference. I don't know what's bothering you, blah, blah, blah," and finally, "Okay." He hit his time right on the nose. I couldn't believe it. We talked about it a while, and we discovered something. It turned out that Tukey was counting in a different way. He was visualizing a tape with numbers on it going by. He would say, "Mary had a little lamb," and he would watch it. Well, now it was clear. He's looking at his tape going by, so he can't read, and I'm talking to myself when I'm counting, so I can't speak. After that discovery, I tried to figure out a way of reading out loud while counting, something neither of us could do. I figured I'd have to use a part of my brain that wouldn't interfere with the seeing or speaking departments. So I decided to use my fingers, since that involved the sense of touch. I soon succeeded in counting with my fingers and reading out loud. But I wanted the whole process to be mental, and not rely on any physical activity. So I tried to imagine the feeling of my fingers moving while I was reading out loud. I never succeeded. I figured that was because I hadn't practiced enough, but it might be impossible. I've never met anybody who can do it. By that experience, Tukey and I discovered that what goes on in different people's heads when they think they're doing the same thing, something as simple as counting, is different for different people. And we discovered that you can externally and objectively test how the brain works. You don't have to ask a person how he counts and rely on his own observations of himself. Instead, you observe what he can and can't do while he counts. The test is absolute. There's no way to beat it. No way to fake it. It's natural to explain an idea in terms of what you already have in your head. Concepts are piled on top of each other. This idea is taught in terms of that idea, and that idea is taught in terms of another idea, which comes from counting, which can be so different for different people. I often think about that, especially when I'm teaching some esoteric technique, such as integrating Bessel functions. When I see equations, I see the letters in colors. I don't know why. As I'm talking, I see vague pictures of Bessel functions from Yonke and Emda's book, with light tan J's, slightly violent bluish N's, and dark brown X's flying around. And I wonder what the hell it must look like to the students. Getting ahead. One time back in the 50s, when I was returning from Brazil by boat, we stopped off in Trinidad for a day, so I decided to see the main city, Port of Spain. In those days, when I visited a city, I was most interested in seeing the poorest sections, to see how life works at the bottom end. I spent some time off in the hills, in the Negro section of town, wandering around on foot. On the way back, a taxi stopped, and the driver said, "Hey, man, you want to see the city? It only costs 5 biwi. I said, "Okay," and got in the taxi. The driver started right off to go up and see some palace, saying, "I'll show you all the fancy places." I said, "No, thank you. That's similar in every city. I want to see the bottom part of the city, where the poor people live. I've already seen the hills up there." "Oh," he said, impressed. "I'll be glad to show you around. And I have a question for you when we're through, so I want you to look at everything carefully." So he took me to an East Indian neighborhood. It must have been some housing project. And he stopped in front of a house made of concrete blocks. There was practically nothing inside. A man was sitting on the front steps. "You see that man?" he said. "He has a son studying medicine in Maryland." Then he picked up someone from the neighborhood so I could better see what they were like. It was a woman whose teeth had a lot of decay. Further along, we stopped and he introduced me to two women he admired. "They got enough money together to buy a sewing machine, and now they do sewing and tailoring work for people in the neighborhood," he said proudly. When he introduced me to them, he said, "This man is a professor, and what's interesting is, he wants to see our neighborhoods." We saw many things, and finally the taxi driver said to me, "Now, professor, here is my question. You see, the Indian people are just as poor, and sometimes even poorer than the Negro people, but they're getting somewhere, somehow. This man has sent his son to college. Those women are building up a sewing business. But my people aren't getting anywhere. Why is that?" I told him, of course, that I didn't know, which is my answer to almost every question. But he wouldn't accept that coming from a professor. I tried to guess at something which I thought was possible. I said, "There's a long tradition behind life in India that comes from a religion and philosophy that is thousands of years old, and although these people are not in India, they still pass on those traditions about what's important in life, trying to build for the future, and supporting their children in the effort, which have come down to them for centuries." I continued, "I think that your people have unfortunately not had a chance to develop such a long tradition, or if they did, they lost it through conquest and slavery. I don't know if it's true, but it was my best guess." The taxi driver felt that it was a good observation and said he was planning to build for the future, too. He had some money on the horses, and if he won, he would buy his own taxicab and really do well. I felt very sorry. I told him that betting on the horses was a bad idea, but he insisted it was the only way he could do it. He had such good intentions, but his method was going to be luck. I wasn't going to go on philosophizing, so he took me to a place where there was a steel band playing some great calypso music, and I had an enjoyable afternoon. Hotel City. One time, when I was in Geneva, Switzerland, for a physical society meeting, I was walking around and happened to go past the United Nations buildings. I thought to myself, "Gee, I think I'll go in and look around." I wasn't particularly dressed for it. I was wearing dirty pants and an old coat. But it turned out there were tours you could go on, where some guy would show you around. The tour was quite interesting. But the most striking part was the great big auditorium. You know how everything is overdone for these big international characters. So what would ordinarily be a stage or a dais was in several layers. You have to climb up whole sequences of steps to get to this great big monstrous wooden thing that you stand behind, with a big screen in back of you. In front of you are the seats. The carpets are elegant, and the big doors with brass handles at the back are beautiful. On each side of the great auditorium up above are windowed booths for translators of different languages to work in. It's a fantastic place, and I kept thinking to myself, gee, how it must be to give a talk in a place like this. Right after that, we were walking along the corridor just outside the auditorium when the guide pointed through the window and said, "You see those buildings over there that are under construction? They'll be used for the first time at the Atoms for Peace conference in about 6 weeks." I suddenly remembered that Murray Gell-Mann and I were supposed to give talks at that conference on the present situation of high-energy physics. My talk was set for the plenary session, so I asked the guide, "Sir, where would the talks for the plenary session of that conference be?" "Back in that room that we just came through." "Oh," I said in delight, "then I'm going to give a speech in that room." The guide looked down at my dirty pants and my sloppy shirt. I realized how dumb that remark must have sounded to him, but it was a genuine surprise and delight on my part. We went along a little bit farther, and the guide said, "This is a lounge for the various delegates, where they often hold informal discussions." There were some small square windows in the doors to the lounge that you could look through, so people looked in. There were a few men sitting there talking. I looked through the windows and saw Igor Tom, a physicist from Russia that I know. "Oh," I said, "I know that guy," and I started through the door. The guide screamed, "No, no, don't go in there." By this time, he was sure he had a maniac on his hands, but he couldn't chase me because he wasn't allowed to go through the door himself. Tom's face lit up when he recognized me, and we talked a little bit. The guide was relieved and continued the tour without me, and I had to run to catch up. At the Physical Society meeting, my good friend Bob Backer said to me, "Listen, it's going to be hard to get a room when that Atoms for Peace conference is going on. Why don't you have the State Department arrange a room for you if you haven't already made a reservation?" "Nah," I said, "I'm not going to have the State Department do a damn thing for me. I'll do it myself." When I returned to my hotel, I told them I would be leaving in a week, but I'd be coming back at the end of summer. Could I make a reservation now for that time? "Certainly. When will you be returning?" "The second week in September." "Oh, we're terribly sorry, Professor Feynman. We are already completely booked for that time." So I wandered off from one hotel to another and found they were all booked solid, 6 weeks ahead of time. Then I remembered a trick I used once when I was with a physicist friend of mine, a quiet and dignified English fellow. We were going across the United States by car, and when we got just beyond Tulsa, Oklahoma, there were supposed to be big floods up ahead. We came into this little town, and we saw cars parked everywhere with people and families in them trying to sleep. He says, "We had better stop here. It's clear we can go no further." "Aw, come on," I say. "How do you know? Let's see if we can do it. Maybe by the time we get there, the water will be down." "We shouldn't waste time," he replies. "Perhaps we can find a room in a hotel if we look for it now." "Aw, don't worry about it," I say. "Let's go." We drive out of town about 10 or 12 miles and come to an arroyo. Yes, even for me, there's too much water. There's no question. We aren't going to try to get through that. We turn around, my friend's muttering about how we'll have no chance of finding a room in a hotel now, and I tell him not to worry. Back in town, it's absolutely blocked with people sleeping in their cars, obviously because there are no more rooms. All the hotels must be packed. I see a small sign over a door. It says hotel. It was the kind of hotel I was familiar with in Albuquerque, when I would wander around town looking at things, waiting to see my wife at the hospital. You have to go up a flight of stairs, and the office is on the first landing. We go up the stairs to the office, and I say to the manager, "We'd like a room." "Certainly, sir. We have one with 2 beds on the 3rd floor." My friend is amazed. The town is packed with people sleeping in cars, and here's a hotel that has room. We go up to our room, and gradually it becomes clear to him. There's no door on the room, only a hanging cloth in the doorway. The room was fairly clean. It had a sink. It wasn't so bad. We get ready for bed. He says, "I've got to pee. The bathroom is down the hall." We hear girls giggling and walking back and forth in the hall outside, and he's nervous. He doesn't want to go out there. "That's all right, just pee in the sink," I say. "But that's unsanitary." "Nah, it's okay. You just turn the water on." "I can't pee in the sink," he says. We're both tired, so we lie down. It's so hot that we don't use any covers, and my friend can't get to sleep because of the noises in the place. I kind of fall asleep a little bit. A little later, I hear a creaking of the floor nearby, and I open one eye slightly. There he is, in the dark, quietly stepping over to the sink. Anyway, I knew a little hotel in Geneva called the Hotel City, which was one of those places with just a doorway on the street and a flight of stairs leading up to the office. There were usually some rooms available, and nobody made reservations. I went up the stairs to the office and told the desk clerk that I'd be back in Geneva in 6 weeks, and I'd like to stay in their hotel. Could I make a reservation? "Certainly, sir, of course." The clerk wrote my name on a piece of paper. They hadn't any book to write reservations in, and I remember the clerk trying to find a hook to put the paper on to remember. So I had my reservation, and everything was fine. I came back to Geneva 6 weeks later, went to the Hotel City, and they did have the room ready for me. It was on the top floor. Although the place was cheap, it was clean. It's Switzerland. It was clean. There were a few holes in the bedspread, but it was a clean bedspread. In the morning, they served a European breakfast in my room. They were rather delighted to have this guest, who had made a reservation 6 weeks in advance. Then I went over to the UN for the first day of the Adams for Peace conference. There was quite a line at the reception desk, where everyone was checking in. A woman was taking down everybody's address and phone number, so they could be reached in case there were any messages. "Where are you staying, Professor Feynman?" she asks. "At the Hotel City."
"Oh, you must mean the Hotel Cité."
"No, it's called City, C-I-T-Y. "Why not? We would call it Cité here in America, so they called it City in Geneva because it sounded foreign."
"But it isn't on our list of hotels. Are you sure it's City?"
"Look in the telephone book for the number. You'll find it."
"Oh," she said after checking the phone book. "My list is incomplete. Some people are still looking for a room, so perhaps I can recommend the Hotel City to them."
She must have got the word about the Hotel City from someone, because nobody else from the conference ended up staying there. Once in a while, the people at the Hotel City would receive telephone calls for me from the UN and would run up the two flights of stairs from the office to tell me, with some awe and excitement, to come down and answer the phone. There's an amusing scene I remember from the Hotel City. One night I was looking through my window out into the courtyard. Something in a building across the courtyard caught the corner of my eye. It looked like an upside-down bowl on the windowsill. I thought it had moved, so I watched it for a while, but it didn't move any. Then, after a bit, it moved a little to one side. I couldn't figure out what this thing was. After a while, I figured it out. It was a man with a pair of binoculars that he had against the windowsill for support, looking across the courtyard to the floor below me. There's another scene at the Hotel City which I'll always remember, that I'd love to be able to paint. I was returning one night from the conference and opened the door at the bottom of the stairway. There was the proprietor standing there trying to look nonchalant with a cigar in one hand while he pushed something up the stairs with the other. Farther up, the woman who brought me breakfast was pulling on this same heavy object with both hands. At the top of the stairs, at the landing, there she was, with her fake furs on, bust sticking out, hand on her hip, imperiously waiting. Her customer was a bit drunk and was not very capable of walking up the steps. I don't know whether the proprietor knew that I knew what this was all about. I just walked past everything. He was ashamed of his hotel, but of course, to me, it was delightful. Who the hell is Herman? One day I got a long-distance telephone call from an old friend in Los Alamos. She says in a very serious voice, "Richard, I have some sad news for you. Herman died." I'm always feeling uncomfortable that I don't remember names, and then I feel bad that I don't pay enough attention to people. So I said, "Oh?" trying to be quiet and serious, so I could get more information, but thinking to myself, "Who the hell is Herman?" She says, "Herman and his mother were both killed in an automobile accident near Los Angeles. Since that is where his mother is from, the funeral will be held in Los Angeles at the Rose Hills Mortuary on May 3rd at 3 o'clock. Then she says, "Herman would have liked it very, very much to know that you would be one of his pallbearers." I still can't remember him. I say, "Of course, I'd be happy to do that. At least this way I'll find out who Herman is." Then I get an idea. I call up the mortuary. "You're having a funeral on May 3rd at 3 o'clock. Which funeral do you mean, the Goldschmidt funeral or the Parnell funeral?" "Well, I don't know." It still doesn't click for me. I don't think it's either one of them. Finally, I say, "It might be a double funeral. His mother also died." "Oh, yes. Then it's the Goldschmidt funeral." "Herman Goldschmidt." "That's right. Herman Goldschmidt and Mrs. Goldschmidt." "Okay. It's Herman Goldschmidt. But I still can't remember a Herman Goldschmidt. I haven't any idea what it is I've forgotten. From the way she talked, my friend was sure that Herman and I knew each other well. The last chance I have is to go to the funeral and look into the casket. I go to the funeral, and the woman who had arranged everything comes over dressed in black and says in a sorrowful voice, "I'm so glad you're here. Herman would be so happy if he knew." All this serious stuff. Everybody's got long faces about Herman, but I still don't know who Herman is, though I'm sure that if I knew, I'd feel very sorry that he was dead. The funeral proceeded, and when it came time for everybody to file past the caskets, I went up. I looked into the first casket, and there was Herman's mother. I looked into the second casket, and there was Herman. And I swear to you, I'd never seen him before in my life. It came time to carry the casket out, and I took my place among the pallbearers. I very carefully laid Herman to rest in his grave, because I knew he would have appreciated it. But I haven't any idea to this day who Herman was. Many years later, I finally got up enough courage to bring it up to my friend. "You know that funeral I went to about 10 years ago for Howard?"
"You mean Herman?"
"Oh, yeah, Herman. You know, I didn't know who Herman was. I didn't even recognize him in the casket."
"But, Richard, you knew each other in Los Alamos just after the war. You were both good friends of mine, and we had many conversations together."
"I still can't remember him." A few days later, she called and told me what might have happened. Maybe she had met Herman just after I had left Los Alamos, and therefore got the timing mixed up somehow. But because she was such good friends with each of us, she thought we must have known each other. So she was the one who had made the mistake, not me, which is usually the case. Or was she just being polite? Feynman, Sexist Pig. A few years after I gave some lectures for the freshmen at Caltech, which were published as the Feynman Lectures on Physics, I received a long letter from a feminist group. I was accused of being anti-woman because of two stories. The first was a discussion of the subtleties of velocity, and involved a woman driver being stopped by a cop. There's a discussion about how fast she was going, and I had her raise valid objections to the cop's definitions of velocity. The letter said I was making the woman look stupid. The other story they objected to was told by the great astronomer Arthur Eddington, who had just figured out that the stars get their power from burning hydrogen in a nuclear reaction producing helium. He recounted how, on the night after his discovery, he was sitting on a bench with his girlfriend. She said, "Look how pretty the stars shine," to which he replied, "Yes, and right now I'm the only man in the world who knows how they shine." He was describing a kind of wonderful loneliness you have when you make a discovery. The letter claimed that I was saying a woman is incapable of understanding nuclear reactions. I figured there was no point in trying to answer their accusations in detail, so I wrote a short letter back to them.
Don't bug me, man.
Needless to say, that didn't work too well. Another letter came. Your response to our letter of September 29th is unsatisfactory, blah, blah, blah. This letter warned that if I didn't get the publisher to revise the things they objected to, there would be trouble. I ignored the letter and forgot about it. A year or so later, the American Association of Physics Teachers awarded me a prize for writing those books and asked me to speak at their meeting in San Francisco. My sister Joan lived in Palo Alto, an hour's drive away, so I stayed with her the night before, and we went to the meeting together. As we approached the lecture hall, we found people standing there giving out handbills to everybody going in. We each took one and glanced at it. At the top it said, "A protest." Then it showed excerpts from the letters they sent me, and my response in full. It concluded in large letters, "Feynman, sexist pig." Joan stopped suddenly and rushed back. "These are interesting," she said to the protester. "I'd like some more of them." When she caught up with me, she said, "Gee whiz, Richard, what did you do?" I told her what had happened as we walked into the hall. At the front of the hall, near the stage, were two prominent women in the American Association of Physics Teachers. One was in charge of women's affairs for the organization, and the other was Faye Adzenberg, a professor of physics I knew from Pennsylvania. They saw me coming down towards the stage, accompanied by this woman with a fistful of handbills, talking to me. Faye walked up to her and said, "Do you realize that Professor Feynman has a sister that he encouraged to go into physics, and that she has a Ph.D. in physics?" "Of course I do," said Joan. "I'm that sister." Faye and her associate explained to me that the protesters were a group led by a man, ironically, who were always disrupting meetings in Berkeley. "We'll sit on either side of you to show our solidarity. And just before you speak, I'll get up and say something to quiet the protesters," Faye said. Because there was another talk before mine, I had time to think of something to say. I thanked Faye, but declined her offer. As soon as I got up to speak, half a dozen protesters marched down to the front of the lecture hall and paraded right below the stage, holding their picket signs high, chanting, "Feynman, sexist pig! Feynman, sexist pig!" I began my talk by telling the protesters, "I'm sorry that my short answer to your letter brought you here unnecessarily. There are more serious places to direct one's attention towards improving the status of women in physics than these relatively trivial mistakes, if that's what you want to call them, in a textbook. But perhaps, after all, it's good that you came. For women do indeed suffer from prejudice and discrimination in physics, and your presence here today serves to remind us of these difficulties and the need to remedy them." The protesters looked at one another. Their picket signs began to come slowly down, like sails in a dying wind. I continued, "Even though the American Association of Physics Teachers has given me an award for teaching, I must confess I don't know how to teach. Therefore, I have nothing to say about teaching. Instead, I would like to talk about something that will be especially interesting to the women in the audience. I would like to talk about the structure of the proton." The protesters put their picket signs down and walked off. My host told me later that the man and his group of protesters had never been defeated so easily. Recently, I discovered a transcript of my speech, and what I said at the beginning doesn't seem anywhere near as dramatic as the way I remember it. What I remember saying is much more wonderful than what I actually said. After my talk, some of the protesters came up to press me about the woman driver story. "Why did it have to be a woman driver?" they said. "You are implying that all women are bad drivers." "But the woman makes the cop look bad," I said. "Why aren't you concerned about the cop?" "That's what you expect from cops," one of the protesters said. "They're all pigs." "But you should be concerned," I said. "I forgot to say in the story that the cop was a woman." I just shook his hand. Can you believe it? For some years now, the Kyoto University has been inviting me to visit Japan. But every time I accepted their invitation, I would happen to get sick and not be able to go. In the summer of 1986, there was going to be a conference in Kyoto, and the university again invited me to come. Although I loved Japan and wanted very much to visit, I felt uncomfortable at the invitation because I had no paper to give. The university said it would be all right for me to give a summary paper, but I said I don't like to do that. But then they said they would be honored if I would be the chairman of one session of the conference. That's all I would have to do. So I finally said okay. I was lucky this time and didn't get sick. Note: Feynman was suffering from abdominal cancer. He had surgery in 1978 and 1981. After he returned from Japan, he had more surgery in October 1986 and October 1987. End of note. So Gwyneth and I went to Kyoto, and I was chairman of one session. The chairman is supposed to make sure that the speakers only talk for a certain length of time, in order to leave enough time for the next speaker. The chairman occupies a position of such high honor that there are two co-chairmen to assist him. My co-chairman said they would take care of introducing the speakers, as well as telling them when it's time to stop. Things went smoothly for most of the session until one speaker, a Japanese man, didn't stop talking when his time was up. I look at the clock and figure it's time he should stop. I look over at the co-chairman and gesture a little bit.
They come up to me and say, "Don't do anything. We'll take care of it. He's talking about Yukawa."
Note: Hideki Yukawa, eminent Japanese physicist, Nobel Prize, 1949. End of note.
It's all right.
So I was the honorary chairman of one session, and I felt I didn't even do my job right. And for that, the university paid my way to Japan. They took care of arranging my trip, and they were all very gracious. One afternoon, we were talking to the host, who was arranging our trip. He shows us a railroad map, and Gwyneth sees a curved line with lots of stops in the middle of the Isa Peninsula. It's not near the water. It's not near anywhere. She puts her finger on the end of the line and says, "We want to go here." He looks at it and says,
"Oh, you want to go to Isokitsu?"
She says, "Yes."
"But there's nothing in Isokitsu," he says, looking at me as if my wife is crazy,
and hoping I'll bring her back to her senses. So I say, "Yes, that's right. We want to go to Isokitsu." Gwyneth hadn't talked to me about it, but I knew what she was thinking. We enjoy traveling to places in the middle of nowhere, places we've never heard of, places which have nothing. Our host becomes a little bit upset. He's never made a hotel reservation for Isokitsu. He doesn't even know if there's an inn there. He gets on the telephone and calls up Isokitsu for us. In Isokitsu, it turns out, there are no accommodations. But there's another town, about 7 kilometers beyond the end of the line, that has a Japanese-style inn. We say, "Fine, that's just what we want, a Japanese-style inn." They give him the number and he calls. The man at the inn is very reluctant.
"Ours is a very small inn. It's a family-run place."
"That's what they want," our host reassures him. "Did he say yes?" I ask. After more discussion, our host says he agrees. But the next morning, our host gets a telephone call from the same inn. Last night, they had a family conference. They decided they can't handle the situation. They can't take care of foreigners. I say, "What's the trouble?" Our host telephones the inn and asks what the problem is. He turns to us and says,
"It's the toilet. They don't have a Western-style toilet."
I say, "Tell them that the last time my wife and I went on a trip, we carried a small shovel and toilet paper and dug holes for ourselves in the dirt. Ask him, shall we bring our shovel?" Our host explains this over the telephone, and they say,
"It's okay. You can come for one night. You don't need to bring your shovel."
The innkeeper picked us up at the railroad station in Isokitsu and took us to his inn. There was a beautiful garden outside our room. We noticed a brilliant emerald-green tree frog climbing a metal frame with horizontal bars, used for hanging out the wet clothes, and a tiny yellow snake in a shrub in front of our ngawa, veranda.
Yes, there was nothing in Isokitsu,
but everything was beautiful and interesting to us. It turned out there was a shrine about a mile away. That's why this little inn was there. So we walked to it. On our way back, it began to rain. A guy passed us in his car, then turned around and came back.
"Where are you going?"
he asked in Japanese.
"To the inn," I said. So he took us there.
When we got back to our room, we discovered that Gwyneth had lost a roll of film, perhaps in the man's car. so I got the dictionary out and looked up film and lost and tried to explain it to the innkeeper. I don't know how he did it, but he found the man who had given us the ride, and in his car we found the film. The bath was interesting.